Luke 12, verses 1. We're going to begin with verse 1, and then we will jump to 13 through 21. So, Luke 12, verse 1, verses 13 through 21. And I'm just going to give a few opening comments about this, and I'm going to work through the text itself. Then I'm going to take a little rabbit trail, and I'm going to sort of work back to the text itself if I have enough time. So that's my plan for this morning. I want you to, as I begin this, though, I want to just say that this particular passage here in Luke it's classic Luke writing. So you will recall, as I've said numerous times, that all of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, although they are similar in appearance, each of those gospels sort of tend to emphasize different themes or different kinds of things in their writing. And so Luke was the apostle who really focused on things having to do with the poor, the sick, not the impoverished, but the people who were alienated or marginalized within the culture, particularly whether they were slaves or women or those kinds of people. But it was the demographic that typically didn't have power that Luke really paid a lot of attention to. And so Luke is distinct in this way. And so as we study Luke in parables, you can't get away from these reoccurring themes. And so this is sort of classical Luke. And as we begin here in verse 1, it says, "Meanwhile, when a crowd of many thousands had gathered so that they were trampling on one another, Jesus began to speak first to his disciples." So Jesus, just setting the context, Jesus was teaching his disciples while there was thousands of people standing around. And so they were listening to what Jesus was saying to his disciples. And in this particular thing, as we are about to find out, Jesus is warning them of the subversiveness and the hypocrisy of the Pharisees and the people in power of his day. And so as Luke goes on, prior to verse 12, he's talking about how even though there's this subversiveness and this hypocrisy and these people who are in power, that they were not to be afraid in this world, but rather not to be afraid of the Pharisees and kings and monarchs, but rather to be afraid not only of those who could destroy the body, but rather also be concerned, live for, respect, honor he who could destroy both the body and the soul. So he goes on to say that. If God can take care of sparrows, he will certainly take care of us, and provides encouragement and warning to acknowledge God during those times of persecution. And that during those times of persecution, not to worry, because God would provide his Holy Spirit for provision and to give us the words that we need to defend ourselves in that day. And so Luke is in essence saying, Jesus is in essence saying, that the primacy of God in our lives is first, and that as we make him primary in our lives, that he provides the watch care over our lives that's necessary. So then going on to verse 13. So after Jesus says all that in verse 13, Luke just sort of just says this. It's kind of like an interruption, blurting out of verse 13. "Someone in the crowd said to him, 'Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me.' Jesus replied, 'Man, who appointed me to judge or be an arbitrator between you?'" Verse 15. "Then he said to them, 'Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions.'" And so I want to just go back then, if I could, to verse 13, make some comments, and we'll move on. Here we have this thing where Jesus is teaching his disciples, and he's talking to them about who to be concerned about, who to watch out for, who you need to live for. And as he's doing that, all of a sudden, somebody just sort of blurts out and says, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Now, it was very typical back then for rabbis or teachers to arbitrate people who had disputes with each other. And certainly in this case, if there was a dispute about an inheritance, many rabbis would have been involved with that. It's interesting that Luke just describes this guy as somebody out of the crowd. And that this person just sort of blurts out, teacher, and it's almost like, I don't want to say it was a test, but what's implied here is if somebody's going to blurt that out in a crowd, then it probably was public information that this guy had an issue with his brother. And I don't know if you know this or not, but when it comes to inheritances, the firstborn son inherited twice the inheritance, and then the balance of the inheritance was divided among the remaining children. So apparently, this guy had an issue where he felt like he was not getting what he should have gotten. And the fact that he was willing to sort of blurt it out in public like that sort of indicates that everybody knew about it. And so I get the sense in which when he did this, that there was a lot of discussion about how Jesus was sort of solving a lot of the problems of the world, or he had an idea about how to solve a lot of the problems in the world. And so this guy says, well, I have a problem, and my problem is my brother won't be fair or just in how I should be in the portion of the inheritance that I should be getting. That's sort of what's going on here. Excuse me. And so he desires justice, and he's clearly alienated from his brother, the firstborn. So he thought he would give Jesus this shot to solve the problem. And I think that what Jesus is, you know, Jesus' response, as you will see here in a few minutes, I think Jesus is like, look, I since verse 1, I've been talking about what's really important and what's really good and how you ought to orient your life. Have you not heard anything that I have said? And so his response later on is, man, who appointed me to be judge or arbiter over you? And so what Jesus was going after in one sense was, look, it's God who really should be fulfilling in our life. It's God who gives us the security that we need. It's God who should bring whatever happiness or joy. God ought to be the center of all of that. And you are making a public spectacle of yourself by asking me to be an arbiter and a judge over this dispute that you have in your family. And so what you've done is you haven't heard a thing I said, and you're asking me to fix it when in reality you're the one that has to fix it. You're the one that has to have a change of heart. And so we go on to verse 15. He said to them, watch out and be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. So Jesus kind of had an idea that something was going on in this man's life and his family's life, and that probably on the pretense of not getting what he perceived to be a fair shake in the inheritance, he was being greedy, and he was embarrassing and dishonoring his family publicly in front of thousands of people on this issue. Now, I'm sure none of you have ever heard of any other family member who took issue with the inheritance that they received, right? Have you ever heard of that before, where people get upset because they felt like they didn't get what they were supposed to get when their parents or a family member died or whatever? I remember I was talking to it was one of the funerals of one of our family members. I was sitting up front in the hearse as we were taking the coffin. I think it was my dad. And we were sitting in the front seat. And I got in a conversation with the mortician, the guy who ran the funeral home where my father was buried. And I don't recall what led up to the conversation, but he did say this to me. He said, look, he says, I've driven the hearse, and I could hear behind me family members arguing and fighting with each other. The coffin is right behind them, and they are arguing and fighting about who should have got what and who didn't get what and things like that. So You know, and, you know, being in the ministry for as long as I've been, I can tell you there's a lot of that that goes on, right? And you know what? It's not always fair and it's not always just. And parents don't always do for their kids what they should have done. Sometimes they privilege certain kids over other kids, and it's not always fair or always just. And sometimes siblings are afforded a certain kind of security because of what parents leave some kids and they don't leave other kids. Sometimes it's really disaffirming when some parents or relatives leave something for certain kids and not other kids. And it's hurtful. But when that happens, there's no fixing it. You can't go back and tell them to redo the will. It is what it is. And so the question becomes, how will we choose to handle that? Are we going to live with bitterness the rest of our lives? Are we going to be alienated from our family? Are we going to tell our kids how hurt and angry and how unfair and how unjust? Or will we allow that to push us and to shove us closer to God and to receive the comfort and the security that He gives us during those times? Because I can tell you, I know them more than my fair share of people who live with that bitterness and that anger in those kinds of circumstances. And the truth of the matter is, if you really want to live a healthy life and you want to pass something on that's better for your children and for everybody else that's watching, you just have to let it go. You have to learn how to let it go. And sometimes, if you have an opportunity where if you've, like, let's say you've been the recipient. Let's say you've been the person that's been blessed more than the other siblings. Maybe you have an opportunity to share that additional blessing that you got that the other sibling didn't get, or siblings. Maybe that's an opportunity as a believer, as a person in Christ, to do that. I don't know. Could be. So when Jesus says there's all manner, all kinds of greed, sometimes we use circumstances in life and we argue the justice of it, but in reality what's behind it is greed. That's what's behind it. And that's what was behind this particular guide here. Greed is a pervasive thing. Some of you weren't around in the 1980s. I was around the 1980s, but the 1980s has been sort of declared the decade of greed. And so we had these phrases that came up in the 1980s. Do you remember this? He who dies with the most toys wins. Remember that? That was a 1980s articulation. Or the phrase conspicuous consumption. You know what a conspicuous consumer is, right? A person who buys something that's a high-end thing, not necessarily because of the quality or whatever of it, but because it's conspicuous. It helps you to look good. It helps you to look sophisticated. It helps you, you know, to sort of establish a pecking order over and above other people. I remember in the 1980s, my wife worked for some insurance company, and we buy a lot of our stuff at like Gabriel Brothers and outlets and stuff like that. But I do believe this. But for the most part, you get what you pay for. I think that's true of most things that you buy. You get what you pay for. And I think that sometimes it's poor stewardship to buy something that's less money and you have to replace it again and again and again and again. Excuse me, I'm sorry, I have a little bit of a tickle. As opposed to just buying once and then having that thing last for years and years and years. I think there's some real advantage to that. And so we like to go to like Gabriel Brothers because we can buy, you know, nicer clothes on because they've been returns or shoes or whatever. That's what we like. That's what we do a lot of times. So I got to remember. Yes, here's what it was. So I ran across this. It was an outlet or something like this. I ran across this Louis Vuitton book bag that that was at an outlet someplace, and I was by myself and I saw it. It probably was a knockoff from China or something, you know? And I probably paid a fraction. Thank you so much, Jim. I paid a fraction of what it was really, you know, what it would really cost. And so I bought it and I took it home for Ruth. And she had a coworker at this insurance company that she worked with who was way into conspicuous consumption. So, like, at the time, a Louis Vuitton, like, little wallet you could pay $100 for or something like that. So this was a book bag, so it was bigger, right? And she took it to work, and he just couldn't for the life of him figure out how we could afford a Louis Vuitton book bag. It was just, it just perplexed him. Do you remember that?
Yes, he was her boss.
Yeah, he was her boss. So, anyway, it just perplexed him entirely. So, but people are like that. People are just sort of way into conspicuous consumption things. And we're all tempted by that. I don't think there's a, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I'm tempted by that. I mean, I really have to, and what I've learned to do over time is that when I want to buy something that's a fairly big ticket item, like something that's around $100 or more, it used to be I was a spontaneous purchaser. You know, I would buy because it made me feel better. But then I would hate myself afterwards because you're trying to pay for it or whatever, you know. But I've learned to look at something and to want it and then to walk away. And when I walk away, I have to ask myself the question, why do I really want to get this? What are the advantages? What are the disadvantages? Is there something less expensive but still as good? And I do that. And I want to tell you, that has changed radically how I spend my money. And I'm far less inclined to buy stuff that I would normally buy anyway, that I would have bought, that I would have purchased in the past. But a lot of times, you know, my eyes would get all big and I'd get all excited about a particular thing because it was something that I could buy and it was conspicuous. And I've learned, not entirely, but I've learned to do better with that than what I used to do. You remember the term keeping up with the Joneses? You know, it's just really astounding. You know, when I was a kid, I think one of the big things was the Keller TV. And you remember I told you that story when I was growing up, that when you had a Keller TV, everybody in the neighborhood knew. Everybody in the neighborhood wanted to come over and watch a Steeler game. And it was usually this huge cabinet, took three men to carry in and set up. And you had this antenna thing and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, now, you know, you can buy the same size TV at best, and you can pick it up with two fingers and carry it into the house and set it up, and you get a gazillion channels and all that kind of stuff. So, but there's no end to this keeping up with the Joneses, because these people have these things, then these other people want these things too. And it really was an incredible economic stimulator. And by the way, you know, make no mistake that was driven largely by Madison Avenue. I mean, Madison Avenue knows how to really tap into our sense of discontentedness with their marketing skills. They just know how to do that. And I'm not saying that it's always a bad thing, but I am saying that you have to be careful that you are manipulated and controlled by that in an undue fashion. So, you know, why do we really want this thing? Do we want to keep up with the Joneses? Or do we really need it? Is this something that would really bring us joy? How many things have you bought in the past that you thought would bring you joy, but when you took them home, the joy dissipated in a relatively quick fashion? And then there are other things. Now, I'll tell you, for Father's Day, and you'll think this is foolish, maybe, but for me, I love this kind of stuff. I love iconic kinds of things, but when I walk at night, I always take a walking stick with me, because I'm getting older, and, you know, sometimes, you know, but the other thing is, sometimes you encounter dogs and maybe people or whatever, and so having a walking stick is a good thing. So, I saw on this website a thing called a shillelagh. Do you know what a shillelagh is? A shillelagh is an Irish either walking stick or a cane, or it's a walking stick, and they're made out of black thorn oak, and they have this sort of knob on top that they put lead in there, and it's just really cool looking. And so I said, for Father's Day, I wanted a shillelagh. And so Ruth and the boys bought me a shillelagh. And to this day, for Father's Day, it is with great joy I pick that up and I walk with it at night. It brings me joy. It was a thoughtful gift. I had them sort of put inscribe on the side, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. It's right on the side of the stick. And I walk with that and it brings me joy. It reminds me of my family and all those kinds of things. So I haven't lost my joy for that. That's a family heirloom. I'll treasure that my whole life. But there are many other things, are there not? Things that we buy that we think will make us happy, but they don't really make us happy for long, right? We just want them because we're keeping up with the Joneses. And then finally, and I'm going to conclude with this, and then I'm going to pick up this other half of it next week, I think. This phrase, the only thing that I want is for my children to be happy. And that was, I think, articulated very well in the early 1980s and 1990s. And that's sort of an all-inclusive statement. And basically what we were saying was, I just want my kids to get a college education and to graduate and to make a lot of money so that they can be happy. And the presumption was that if you make a lot of money, you can be happy. Well, I mean, there are so many things that's wrong with this statement. I don't have enough time to go over it. I mean, I can't begin to tell you, for example, that if that is the goal, if the goal for all of us here is just to be happy, if that's the highest form of living that we can conjure up for ourselves is to be happy, then you have entered into a world of complete subjectivism. Because whatever makes one person happy doesn't make another person happy. And so it's what makes me happy personally. And it might be money, it might be a lot of stuff, but it could be other wacky, weird, perverse kinds of things as well, right? So, but this came out of this whole idea where, we just want our kids to be happy and we presume that if they made a lot of money, they would. Look, money solves a lot of problems. But let's not make any mistake, money creates a lot of problems too. And so, you know, if we are master of our money and we are and God is our master in turn, then the priorities are right. But if money is our master, if we live to accrue money, then we are living to accrue problems. I think a lot of kids who were raised in the 1980s and 90s are living lives now in revolt to this. I mean, if you talk to a lot of millennials, this is just really offensive to them. This idea that to be happy, I need money to be happy. And look, some of the parents who thought that, you know, money is being important in terms of solving some problems, I mean, some of that was sincere because they, you know, many of you, my father was born in 1929. You know what happened in 1929? The Great Depression, right? And so I remember people who talked about the Great Depression. I remember them talking about how difficult, how painful, how hard it was. And they were scarred by it. And so when they got older and they had an opportunity to accrue to themselves some money and material things and stuff like that, they can remember back when they had no food, when they couldn't pay the utility bills, when their homes were repossessed and cars and things like that. Money would have solved a lot of problems back then. So I understand how that emerged, but then it really got way out of control. And so now there's some balancing taking place. So what I'm going to do next week then is I'm going to pick up the rest of this text and talk about it and talk about some application for us. And I guess I'll reveal my hand a little bit here too. This is a classic text that talks about, that is used oftentimes today with many Christians about critiques on capitalism. And here's the interesting thing, that for those Christians who use this text as a critique on capitalism, like there are 365,000 churches or so in the United States today. Do you think out of those 360-some-thousand churches, there might be some pastors talking about this text just this morning, just like I am? Do you think there's a good possibility of that? Yes, right? That many churches? Absolutely. And of those pastors who talk about this text, as they talk about this text as a critique on capitalism, how many people do you think in their congregation will be thinking, oh, you're being political? Virtually nobody. Because they'll think that's a fair critique, right? Well, I can say to you that this is also probably a text that should talk about where we should talk about some other things called socialism. But see, if I talk about socialism, then there might be some people say, well, you're being political. Well, no, I'm not being political. I'm talking about what the Lord has to say about how we handle our money. And both capitalism and socialism have a lot to say about how we handle our money. Okay? And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that next week. So if you're concerned that I'm going to talk about that and you think I'm being political, then I will not be political. And by the way, I'm going to be citing somebody who is from sociopolitically from the far left who will support a lot of what I'm saying about how we apply this. So I just think in fairness, and most of you who know me, you know that I try to get to the middle. I try to find the balance between those two things. And so that's what I want to try and do between this. Because in discussing this as a critique on capitalism, where those people go from here is they jump immediately over into the socio-political economic theory of how you should handle money. That's what they do. And I'm saying we got to be careful of that. I think there's a middle way that thoughtful Christians ought to embrace. Does that make sense to you?